Hello, welcome to Farmgate. I'm Finlow Castain. It was once thought that the bounty of the ocean was limitless and that no matter how much we plundered its depths, there would always be plenty more fish in the sea. But the last century has seen a remarkable rise in technological ingenuity, and at the same time, the human population has more than trebled. The vast majority of wild-caught fish are now harvested by industrial-scale trawlers using vast and often indiscriminate nets and bottom trawling, leading to unprecedented levels of bycatch and discards. At the same time, aquaculture has scaled so rapidly that farmed fish now outstrip wild-caught seafood by volume, with over 100 million tonnes produced globally in 2015. As a result, the aquaculture industry has increasingly come under fire for high levels of waste and pollution and for poor welfare. If many of these challenges are offshore and out of mind, then the recent Netflix film Seaspiracy has dredged them back up into public consciousness. This is the first in a series of programs in which we discuss the future of ocean food. I'm joined by Ruth Layton, who, as a former director of FAI Farms, has spent 25 years studying agricultural and aquacultural systems around the world, and by Ashley Bright, an expert in the science of sustainability in global food systems. Welcome both. Ash, can I come to you first? I know there have been criticisms of Seaspiracy. Do you think any of them are justified?
Yes, there are criticisms around some of the facts. For example, that the ocean will be empty by 2048, which has been contradicted by the authors of the study. I think the NGOs were interviewed fairly aggressively, and I think those sorts of things make it easier for people to dismiss. And I don't know how helpful it is painting NGOs in a negative light when they are the ones actually attempting to make a difference. I think also for me to say to just stop eating seafood was presented as a simple sort of silver bullet answer to the issues in the film. But there are billions of people that live in coastal areas and are associated with fishing. They're dependent on seafood for livelihoods, for nutrition and for culture. And it seems like quite a Western take to be able to say just don't eat it. You know, really, are there sort of simple answers to these incredibly complex and interconnected issues? But on the whole, the basic premise of the film, that overfishing is the biggest threat to oceans, that there's a dramatic decline in species, there's an increase in habitat destruction and pollution, that they're all without doubt, and they were the key message. So Seaspiracy, it definitely raised awareness of the ocean's critical importance and the threats they face. And I guess at the end of the day, this, you know, it was a guy that was really, that really cared. He was passionate about the ocean and telling a story which resonated and connected people with this really vital ecosystem. And I think that was really important.
It was certainly a compelling film, wasn't it? The narrative was really clear and you kind of felt very emotional about it. I know one of the concerns that you had was around, towards the end, he had a definition of sustainability. And it was quite an old definition.
Yeah, I think it's towards the end of the film with the whale hunt, and Ellie says, I finally understood sustainability. It just meant that something could continue on and on forever, regardless of how much suffering. But I began to wonder whether sustainability was truly the right goal for how we took care of the ocean. I mean, this take on sustainability is something that can continue or be maintained. It's really quite an outdated one. You know, I think we have contemporary definitions which all include some aspect of taking care of people, animals, environment, and restoring ecological balance. And sustainability, it's really a journey of continuous improvement and evolution, and I don't think that we can expect that the best sustainability practices of today are the same that we would want in 5 years' time. So for me, sustainability in food production, it is being regenerative and restorative, and I think it's actually necessary that we expect that the way our food is produced, you know, provides a benefit to the climate, provides a benefit to biodiversity, can be used to restore habitats and have wider social benefits. It's not just about having a reduced impact on ecosystems.
Ruth, you know, when you first watched it, you said that you felt quite emotional watching the film. I wonder what you found most shocking or upsetting about it.
I guess, Finlow, it's this constant thing that I've seen over the last 20 odd years, looking at these systems in the sea, mainly on land, but also quite a lot of sea systems. It's the scale of them. You know, the scale of them makes it impossible, in my experience, to really care for people people, animals and the environment. And, you know, I watched Seaspiracy myself, and the film highlights some of those issues around people and animals and the environment so well. So, yeah, it's just, you know, how can we really have these massive systems and care? So bottom trawling, for example, how can we bottom trawl and care for the seabed? It's not possible. It's really why I've done what I did through my working life. It's really this lack of respect for life itself. And we intuitively know that it's not right to grab all this food from the sea and from the land and not respect it.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because when you're talking about the way that bottom trawling in particular happens, it makes me think, you know, that this is something which is essentially invisible. If we see cows in a field on a farm, you know, that are looking unkempt and badly treated, if they're looking dirty, we can see that and respond to it. But in these great big systems that you mentioned, whether they're out at sea and they're invisible, or whether they're in great big sheds and essentially it's invisible, it's a step removed from human consciousness. And that must be a problem.
Yes, it's an intuitive thing that we know when we see it, when we see that massive action, waste, it's an intuitive thing as a human being that we know it's not right. Everybody at some level, I would say, knows it's not right. The question is, what do we do and how can we all contribute to that? Because blaming doesn't solve anything. So we all have a responsibility and a part to play in the solutions.
In the world that we live in now, everything has scaled. Scale is fundamental to the way that we live our lives. Is it possible to change that? The scale that you talk about, is it possible to come back from there?
Well, yes, of course it's possible. I mean, we've had throughout history, it's very interesting for me, throughout history, we've had a different type of system. We started farming something like 10, 12,000 years ago, and it's only in the last maximum 100 years, less than that really, that we've developed these huge, huge systems with, you know, our so-called modern technology. And if we apply our brains and our modern technology, we can actually move through this, what I feel is a dreadful phase really in terms of people, animals in the environment, through into something better. And as I said before, we can all contribute to that, and we all have a responsibility to contribute to that. The easy thing to do is to blame somebody else. We all play a part and we all eat food.
It's almost like it's an angry adolescence that the food system has been going through, that, you know, this scaling and just plundering is gradually being questioned by more and more people. And obviously, in terms of the, you know, the conversations that we've been having on the podcast and that you've been having throughout your working life about the introduction of agroecological systems is the start of growing up a little bit as a food system. Ruth, one of the recurring themes in the film is transparency, which I guess is, you know, what we were touching on in terms of things are under the sea or they're in big sheds, they're out of sight and out of mind. And labels help to deliver some of that transparency. I mean, we don't quite get to that point where you can look over a hedge and you can see, you know, the cows that are being mistreated in a particular field, but they're the best we have. And so labels like Dolphin Friendly or Marine Stewardship Council MSC Certified, which were the ones that, you know, Ali was focusing on in Seaspiracy. What role do you think that labels can play in delivering greater sustainability?
It's a real challenge. And all I want to say really is I feel it's great that they exist because many people are genuinely trying to do something positive here. But we need to evolve. And this evolution is really necessary now. We have some great technology which we're not making use of currently. You know, I've got good examples in the agriculture side of technology that we could use. And I think we could apply that same approach to the marine environment, both for wild caught and aquaculture. So I think it's an area to explore, because the danger really is that people will move en masse away from fish as they've moved away from meat. And then, you know, we're just transferring the problem. The issue is to really try to understand and make our best decision. And labels can play a part in that. Yeah, the technology needs to be used more widely.
It's difficult for a lot of people, isn't it? Because a lot of the time, you know, we'll sort of, you know, talk about the importance of direct sales, of people being able to buy, perhaps through cooperatives where, you know, the particular standards associated with that farm species are assured in some way that people can trust, and they people have taken the time to actively search out that food. But for most people, they're still buying food in, you know, in big retail settings, certainly, you know, in Western countries. And so labels must be pretty critical.
I mean, the labels that I would point people to would be organic would be one example. I think fair trade would be another example in terms of people. And again, you know, they don't cover everything and they're not perfect, but they are a start. And, you know, when people like myself and others challenge these leading labels, if you like, it's not because we think the labels don't have a role. It's because we know that there are places where the labels could improve. And it's not so much, it's partly in the standards, but it's more about exactly what the film raised. How do we verify the label is working, if you like? So an example I'd like to give would be if, you know, many people will have watched the film Kiss the Ground, which is a similar sort of thing in a way for land-based. And it's very obvious there that we can use modern technology to see when we've got massive levels of carbon dioxide coming into the atmosphere. We can see when that's happening, and it's linked to the type of agriculture and disturbance of the Earth's crust. Well, maybe there's a similar thing that we can do for the seabed. I don't know. I haven't looked hard enough myself at the moment, and it's an area I'd certainly like to explore more.
And I guess when you talk about technology, there's the option to the way that people farm to be put on Instagram or Twitter, and for those farmers to have regular contact with their customers in that way to demonstrate, you know, the good that they're doing. And there's a degree to which we could see a lot more of that happening, you know, out in terms of ocean fishing at any rate, which still to a large extent for many of us is something that happens over there. Ash, one of the possible solutions to overfishing is regenerative ocean farming. And we're going to come to that in a little while. But just before we do, I wonder if you could outline some of the key challenges with global aquaculture as we understand it today.
Yeah, so the key challenges for aquaculture, they're really the same as we have for agriculture, you know, around the inputs that are required in terms of feed, medicines use, the pollution associated with large numbers of animals in one space, and the conditions for those animals. You know, for carnivorous species of fish like salmon, sea bass, sea bream, and crustaceans such as shrimp, they need a high proportion of protein in their diet, which comes from either soy, which of course is associated with deforestation, or from wild-caught fish. And many of these fisheries are in Southeast Asia, where we don't know much about the sustainability of the stocks. And as Seaspiracy raised, you know, there's human rights issues of the workers on the boats. The other aspect, of course, is animal welfare. When you have large numbers of animals in very confined spaces, you've got problems with infectious disease, high use of medicines to combat these, high mortality rates, animals are kept in conditions which can be stressful and restricts their natural behaviours. You've got water pollution in and around sea cages and ponds coming from animal feed and waste. And lastly, as we were talking about before, when we catch and harvest the fish or crustaceans, there's issues with how humane the slaughter process is.
I think it would be unfair to say that the industry is not aware of these challenges and that, you know, there's been quite a lot of work, hasn't there, to try and resolve some of these issues.
Yes, there has been a lot of work to resolve some of these issues, and, you know, sustainability strategies are inherent in many of the aquaculture companies that are producing a lot of these species. I guess I would say that they tend to veer towards the reducing impacts side of things. So trying to reduce the amount of wild caught fish that is in the feed, trying to certify where the soy comes from, trying to limit the amounts of pollution. We're not sort of really fundamentally changing the way these systems operate. They're more tweaks around the system, and we're still scaling up to a large degree and producing more and more animals in these systems.
There's also the issue of sentience, isn't there, which is kind of the cornerstone of science around the welfare of farmed species. And a lot of people grow up with the idea that fish have short memories and they don't particularly feel pain in the same way that other animals do. That's not right, is it?
No, I mean, they have a central nervous system. We know that they experience pain, that they can experience suffering. And, you know, we have a duty of care in farming these animals to provide them with the environments that meet their well-being and provide them with positive experiences.
And so if we think about slaughter is a good example. You know, when we're talking about fish by and large, it's, you know, they're being taken out of the sea. They're suffocating, they're drowning in the air. And aquaculture does better than that, I think.
There's been a lot of development over the years in killing fish. So I think we need to distinguish between finfish and other fish. So finfish are the most sentient fish, if you like, although there is evidence that other fish or the fish species have sentience, and octopus is the obvious example. So there are methodologies that have been developed to stun fish. Yes, but you have to stun them as, you know, individual fish. And many people have worked hard to try and develop those systems. And they do work to a degree. They're not always applied. That's the truth of the matter. They're not always applied. In terms of ocean caught fish, of course, they're not stunned or anything before they're slaughtered. They are just merely taken from the sea and then they suffocate eventually. Yeah, that's what happens. That's the reality.
So it's a very, very different system to all of the animals that we, you know, that we're used to eating on land, you know, that we're used to in terms of a farm species. It's a very different approach to the way that the food is harvested and then the way that those animals are slaughtered and brought to our tables. So it is a very different system and one that clearly, you know, there needs to be more transparency around and a lot more technical innovation. I wonder, Ruth, whether it's possible to overcome some of these sustainability challenges, particularly in aquaculture, without a fundamental shift in what people eat in people's diets?
No is the short answer. It's the same, you know, again, we can easily apply the same process, if you like, to how we've applied it on land. So one of the things that I think has happened is that we know that the consumption of fish has massively increased in recent years. Part of that will be because people have made a shift from land animal protein, if you like, to fish protein. And we can't keep drawing on these resources because it's not a bottomless pit. And we could see that, you know, the film clearly shows that. We can argue about the detail of the figures, but the film clearly shows the drop in the number of species and the effects that we're having and the balance that's needed to maintain a healthy sea. So it's that simple adage which came out of the Farming Smarter report from the FFCC. And they said, basically, eat less and better and more and better. So if you're going to eat animal protein, eat less of it and try and make sure that you eat it from a better system. And like I say, organic might be one system you would point to. Fair trade labels might be another system that you would point to. And more and better of everything else, but that includes your fruit, your vegetables, your grains. You've got to eat better, not just more of it. You have to eat better because there's plenty of those systems that impact animals, people, environment, use chemicals, etc. It's complicated. It's not simple.
So it's not just a case of saying, oh, I've discovered that chicken is bad and therefore I'm going to go and change what I eat and I'm just going to eat as much as I did before, but it's going to be fish this time. And so the less message is important, but more important within that is the better. It's trying to source better. And of course, you know, those labels that we were talking about earlier on are trying in their own way to address that.
People are told that red meat's bad and they move to white meat. Then they're told that white meat's bad, not just for their diet. I mean, in the round, you know, for animals and the people operating the systems. So they go from red meat to white meat to fish. And now we're saying fish is not great either. And then if we get that message across, some of us are going to say, well, you know, be careful about what vegetables and grains you eat, because they're not all brilliant either and can really negatively impact the environment and wild animals, etc. So this is not a simple solution. It's like Ash keeps saying, we have to focus on, are we polluting? Are we putting more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere? Are we destroying our environment in the broader sense? And we need some clear messages so people can eat better, however they choose to eat, whether they choose to eat meat or fish or become vegetarian or vegan. How you eat is really important, and the system through which your food is produced. Can I just add one more thing, Finlow? The pollution of the seas, I don't think we've mentioned this so far, but I think it's an important point. The pollution of the seas, a big chunk of that comes from the land. This is not all about people at sea causing the problem. A lot of the pollution is from our activities on the land.
Ash, you've spent time researching indigenous communities and the way that they harvest food from the ocean. I wonder what you discovered, you know, in that process of research and whether there were common themes that you came across.
Yeah, we were looking at how we could apply apply this concept of regenerative agriculture to seafood. So I was coming at it from a different angle than the technology aspect that Ruth mentioned before with the labels. You know, we were interested in what and how Indigenous and traditional cultures harvested food from the ocean and their methods of aquaculture. So, you know, what could we learn? So for Indigenous peoples, this related primarily to ocean or stream fishing. And by Indigenous, I mean cultures that existed pre-colonially and have maintained this cultural identity. The key common themes that came from that were, the first and most obvious one for me was the spiritual connection, the sense of reverence for the ocean and the food it provides, this sort of sacred integral connection to this ecosystem, not a separation of humans in this ecosystem, so an integral connection. The second is that the decisions on what, when, and where to fish are made by a chief or an elder who has the entire community's well-being in mind. So it's not individualistic. And that status tends to be conferred by how well the community is doing and how that resource has been managed. It's not about how much wealth has been accumulated. Thirdly is the adaptability and the ability to be really selective. So the species and even the age of what was being caught, you know, it varies by the time of year, and the methods vary with the species and the time of year. So almost all methods, they allow for, you know, targeted type and size of species to be selected. And I think this adaptability provides us a certain amount of resiliency. So, for example, if the weather makes fishing trips dangerous, or if a normal fishing or harvesting spot doesn't provide as expected, you have the adaptability to move to a different species or a different size of species.
It's interesting as you say that, not necessarily the spiritual element, but certainly that sort of trying to, you know, having a chief that is making decisions for the broader, wider community and trying to think about which species should be caught and which species shouldn't. There's a lot there that would be underpinning the common fisheries policy of the European Union. You effectively have a chief, you have the commission that has made these decisions on behalf of the European community, but it doesn't work at scale.
No, and I think that has something to do with this community size. The social scientist, is it Robin Dunbar? And he has this number of 150, which above which he says that communities start to break down, our relationships with each other start to break down. And that is something to do with our mental capacity to hold relationships and to remember people and to form meaningful connections with people. And of course, we've got very complicated fisheries relationships, don't we? And you know, which fishing vessels are allowed where and which aren't, and quotas and all that sort of thing, which feeds into the complication.
So again, we come back to that issue of scale. It can work when people have a good knowledge, when they have a certain reverence for what they're doing, when they care about the species and when they care about the people they're employing. And that gets much, much harder as you scale, you know, and certainly when you're up at a kind of a multi-country level like the European Union, there are always going to be, I mean, it's not just the discards of the fish, but discards of communities that are offset against the benefits of other communities elsewhere. I wonder if you're able to sort of talk through one or two of the fishing systems that you came across when you were doing that work, you know, looking at Indigenous communities and the way that they fish.
I guess the two examples I can give is one around Polynesian islands and Pacific islands. They tend to operate on a sort of a balanced harvest type approach. So that's using a wide variety of methods. So, you know, there'll be nets, harpooning, collecting shellfish from the shores, and they will adapt whatever tool that they need and technique that they need to use for the species and the time of year. You know, it's about using what you catch and balancing that out with what you're seeing in the environment at the time. So if you're not seeing large numbers of schools of fish in an area that you might normally be seeing, then you might target something else.
One of the key things that I'm taking from there is the issue of waste, that it sounds like there's very little or no waste in these sort of Indigenous community fishing systems.
Yeah, that was my impression as well. So, you know, everything was used from the animal itself to the skins, and it all had a purpose, you know, and it could be harvested and dried for, you know, winter months as well.
Do you think that there are things that Western communities can learn from these other communities when we're thinking about fishing at a global scale?
Oh, completely. Yeah, I think all the things that I mentioned, you know, before, and maybe the key ones for me that would be driving change are this sense of connection to and reverence for the oceans. And I mean, that can include the land as well. Thinking about the way we produce and harvest food as part of an ecosystem and the variation requiring selectivity and adaptability. So we take what we need, not what we can.
Ruth, we've worked together on scaling agroecology for several years, and I wonder if you think it's possible for fisheries to take some of the same agroecological journey that we've been working to accelerate on the land.
Yes, it's a simple answer. And, you know, I'm looking at this with people like Ash and obviously yourself, and I think there is a way forward. It needs serious focus and attention and people that really, really want to do it. You know, we said a lot in this podcast about community, and the experience I have of society is that it is very difficult to maintain a community feeling and experience, if you like, when we operate these large systems. This is not a blame statement. This is a fact. It's just because the people that are running those systems at the senior level are not connected to what's happening on the ground. And therefore, the pain of it does not register so strongly with them. And of course, we can all be part of that because we are investing in these companies, etc., etc. It's a radical change that's needed in the world if human beings are to stay on the planet. It is as simple as that, really. If we don't change, we will not survive as a species. It sounds a radical statement, but the evidence is clear.
I think that brings us on to the idea of regenerative ocean farming. We've talked about this a couple of times. I've mentioned the phrase. And I wonder, Ash, if you could just help people out by describing what we mean when we talk about regenerative ocean farming. Whether you give us a sense of what that means.
It's farming in a way that restores or regenerates the ocean. So by that I mean the water quality, the marine habitat, the biodiversity, sequesters carbon. It's producing and harvesting food in a way that has a benefit, where we aren't just trying to lessen our impact, but we're trying to do more good from that food production. And the basis of regenerative ocean farming is the polyculture of seaweeds, seagrasses and shellfish. The seaweed is an important underwater habitat for a variety of other fish and crustaceans. So it helps restore the marine ecosystem. It can reduce storm surges and, as I said, can sequester sort of large amounts of carbon. And both the kelp and the sea shellfish can act as water filters, so to help improve water quality. And one of the keys to restorative or regenerative ocean farming is that no feed or other input are needed, and you have a high yield of both seaweed and shellfish. One of the most cited examples of regenerative ocean farming is Thimble Island Farms, which is on the east coast of the United States. They farm kelp, scallops, mussels, clams, and then they established this not-for-profit called Green Wave, where they help to train and finance other restorative ocean farmers. I think they've trained around 120 at the moment, and they're aiming for 10,000. I guess coming back to the scale issue that Ruth was talking about before, so this is scale, but it's not scaling up in terms of having one ever bigger farm. It's about a lot of farmers doing the same thing up and down the coast. So it's scaling by replication as opposed to scaling by increasing in size.
Obviously, we've just been talking about regenerative ocean farming in the United States. Are there other examples of that kind of approach to ocean farming elsewhere in the world?
Actually, polyculture ocean farming, so that's where you've got, you know, two species in one space together. It's actually quite common, particularly in Southeast Asia. It's usually on a household or sort of a local village scale, and they use a variety of different species. But we don't actually have much data about the environmental impacts of those systems and whether they're having a restorative impact or not. But they do exist. Many of them do exist. So it's not just taking place, you know, in places in the West, like in the United States. It is happening at a large scale, you know, in other parts parts of the world. We just don't necessarily have the data.
It's interesting what you talk about there. It sounds like a quite a utopian way of approaching seafood. But when you were describing that, you're talking about kelp and obviously finding a market for the kelp. And you're talking about shellfish. And shellfish, you know, they're an acquired taste for a lot of people. They're very different to the type of fish that, you know, that many people would choose if they were out in the supermarket.
Yes, well, I think that's one of the key challenges to create that demand so that the farmers want to farm regeneratively in the ocean and that it's profitable for them. We need to shift the way we eat, and we need to eat further down the food chain. So these carnivorous species like salmon and shrimp, we need to be eating down the food chain and less of these higher trophic species. But that, you know, that behavioral change is tough. That's not an easy route to take.
It is possible to process shellfish into things like fish fingers and that kind of stuff, which might make it much more palatable for people in a sort of transitional sense.
Yeah, so I guess that's the alternative to, in, you know, what Ali was mentioning in Seaspiracy is these plant-based alternatives to meat. And, you know, and possibly one of the alternatives that we consider is shellfish alternatives to these processed foods.
When you were talking about regenerative ocean farming and the way that it sort of works in this, you know, it's a community that's being built in the sea of kelp and shellfish that are suspended in cages and that sort of thing, rather than being on the sea floor so they don't need to be dredged up. That sounds like an approach. I mean, it's not an approach that's happening in the deep ocean, is it? It's something that's happening in coastal regions. Presumably, it's something that could take place in a marine nature reserve in the same way that it happens anywhere else, because it would be contributing to marine life around it, and what was being grown and extracted would be entirely controlled within that system itself.
Yes, absolutely. I think it would suit marine protected areas, and a lot of those marine protected areas are in coastal regions or within the exclusive economic zones of countries anyway.
Do you think there are any other sort of challenges to scaling this this approach to ocean food?
In the same way that it is for regenerative agriculture, it is for the farmers of regenerative ocean farming. And, you know, it's a mindset change. It's thinking in terms of ecosystem cycles and closing that nutrient loop. It's a fundamental shift from, you know, the extractive approach that we have of wild caught fishing or these high input systems that we've developed for aquaculture. And it's challenging to adopt new ways of farming or assimilate methods from different cultures.
These systems that we've developed with so-called modern technology, which it is modern technology, it's the way it's applied, are not that old in terms of our history as humanity and certainly our farming history. They're barely 100 years old, and we've done a lot of damage in a very short space of time, which is why Ash has talked about the classic sustainability definition. We need to be more regenerative. We can't carry on doing what we're doing now because we're on a depletion cycle at the moment. Things are getting worse year on year, and the evidence for that is massive. This is why many of us talk about regenerative systems. In my view, we don't have an option. If we want to stay on the planet as a species, we have to do something regenerative. And that, again, means all of us. I just want to keep emphasizing this because people want to say the retailers should do this, the farmers should do this, people should do this. Each of us as individuals can do something, and we all need to play our part if we're going to be successful. The planet will survive, human beings may not. And it will be it's pretty messy now for a lot of people, and it can only get worse unless we do something different. And there's such joy in doing something different. I think that's the other thing I want to say. There's complete and utter joy when you see these systems starting to operate and the people involved and the animals involved. There's great joy in it.
Fantastic. Thanks, Ruth. It's great to have a positive note to end on there. Well, that's all we have to that's all we have time for. I'd like to thank my guests, Ruth Layton and Ashley Bright from FAI Farms. If you've enjoyed listening, please come back and listen to more. Tell your friends, like us, review us, and share our links. Farmgate is a partnership project for Farmwell and FAI Farms. We're funded by Sankalpa, and you can join the conversation on Twitter by searching for Farmgate Podcast. I've been Finlow Castain. Bye for now.